thank you for joining us for this episode. I'm here today with two of our talented marine band musicians to talk about sight reading. First, we have our co-principal saxophonist, Master Gunnery Sergeant Steve Temme. How are you, Steve?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
And we also have a member of our clarinet section, Master Sergeant Chris Grant. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, before we get into learning and practicing sight reading, I wanted to get your strategies for sight reading as professional musicians. We sight read in some pretty high-stakes situations here in the band, so do you have a set of series or like specific things that you think of before you start to sight read something, or do you just kind of go?
At this point, I think I just kind of go, but I think what we're going to be talking about today, I think it's the great thing about sight reading and the practice and the skill of it is that it compounds. So the more you do it and over a long period of time, like we've all been playing for quite a while, I'd say, and after many years of doing this, you build a certain level of confidence with it. So I guess I don't think about much when I'm doing it now. However, subconsciously, I'm sure I'm relying on everything that I've practiced in for years with this skill. I don't know how you feel, Chris.
Yeah, I agree with you. And especially that sense of, you know, things have compounded over the years. The parts of sight reading that I've kind of worked on over the years to get to the stage where I am now, where I'm a lot more comfortable with it, you know, some of those real fundamental things. When you look at a chart, you know, you have maybe a minute, 2 minutes to look down a piece of music. You know, you're going to be looking at the key things, you know, what's my tempo going to be? What's my key signature going to be? What's my time signature going to be? You know, and then you start building on those elements. And those are all things that maybe come sort of second nature to us at this point. But that's definitely something that over the years I've had to practice.
So sight reading at your level, I've heard it compared to like reading. Like you open a book and you don't think, okay, I've got to prepare my phonics. I have to see the paragraph structure. You just crack open a book and start reading. So it might take some time for a student to get to that level of sight reading, but would you say you have that sort of fluency with it at this point?
I would say for the most part, yes. Yeah. And of course, there's going to be some things that trip me up every now and again. And when I open a piece of music, if I've never seen it before, or maybe it's been a couple of months since I last saw it, I'm going to be, at this point, looking towards the things that I remember from a previous experience when I read it down once on the fly that was challenging to get through. Or, you know, I might look ahead through the tune and see, okay, well, this is going to be tricky here because of the tempo that's at the beginning. I want to make sure that I don't get bogged down, you know, going too fast where I'm comfortable and find something down the road, you know. I kind of look ahead as much as I can and find the spots that I know might cause me a little bit of trouble.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned tunes that you've read maybe once, because mm-hmm. I find myself using sight reading skills, not just literally the first time I see the notes ever, but if I see the notes for a second time, it's kind of sight reading goes hand in hand with just learning a piece, the first few steps of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we might get into this again later, but I definitely feel like the more you know your instrument and the more skills that you have with your fundamentals, or if it's your scales or your arpeggios, et cetera, those are going to positively influence how you're reading, your grammar, right? Your sentence structure, those things as you're describing it, those are going to impact your ability to sight read something as part of that sort of second nature.
Absolutely. It's the bedrock of, you know, what we do. All those early skills, why we spend hours, you know, playing long tones or scales, you know, that is all the information that you are relying on instantaneously when you're sight reading. So, sure.
And Steve, you mentioned that all of these skills kind of compound and add to your sight reading until it's something where you just kind of go. Was there a moment that you can remember in your playing career where that sort of clicked, where it happened, or you were maybe forced to be sight reading a lot, something where it all kind of came together and you felt comfortable sight reading?
Well, that usually happens for me, or it did happen in ensemble playing, or, you know, maybe duo playing. I used to read, I guess I've always done that, in whether I was in college, in my studio, even when I was here early on in the Marine Band, I remember reading a lot of duos with colleagues just to do it. And that playing together, that skill, I think, continuously builds that instantaneous, you know, again, like we talked about, those skills that you're drawing on immediately when you're sight reading. And so doing that with another person, I mean, A, it's fun. I think it's just enjoyable to do. But you are working on that skill and drawing on all these things you've learned. So a lot of it's come from duo or ensemble playing, small chamber playing.
I really like that idea of smaller ensembles, because when you're working in, like I am, often in a section of folks, you're able to work together as one larger unit. But when you break that down into, say, two people working together, the smaller the group, the more dependent you are on each other, keeping time, keeping the key, making sure you're not dropping things as you're working through. So I really like that idea of working together.
Yeah, and there's that vulnerable sense too with another, which is great.
You know, absolutely.
We're going to mess up. And that's expected, and we do, and it's even fun in that way. And you're hearing each other mess up, you know, the pressure is a little bit lower. But you're still honing that skill, but there's less pressure with it. It is fun, and you kind of roll with those times that you mess up. But we'll talk about how, you know, in sight reading, you got to keep going. You have to forge your way forward no matter what. And so that's a fun way to do that.
Yeah, I like that you bring up small ensemble playing, because now that I'm reflecting on it, I kind of am just now having this realization that when I was kind of sink or swim learning sight reading was in grad school in saxophone quartet rehearsals.
Yeah.
If any of you are listening, mm-hmm. I apologize. But I was very, very busy at a certain point in my grad school career, and I just would show up to these rehearsals like, okay, I maybe didn't practice as much as I wanted to going into this rehearsal, but I've got to be one of the four members of this musical ensemble, and I've just got to go. And so that kind of forced me to get into this mode that you're talking about. So it's going to take some time for a student's sight reading to look like all of that. You know, I don't know how many of us think of sight reading as like reading a book. That's a pretty fluent level. But I found that there's a lot of preparation that goes into being a good sight reader that isn't specifically practicing sight reading. And we touched on this already a little bit, but Chris, what kind of preparations can students take to improve their sight reading before they even sight read?
It's a great question. To use Steve's word from earlier, sort of the bedrock of what we do as musicians, the real fundamental level of things. So if you're talking about practicing your scales, practicing your arpeggios, making sure that your articulation is the best it can be, you know, all of these things, understanding key signatures, understanding time signatures, understanding the rhythms, all of those real basic fundamental level things that we work on a regular basis. Maybe not even practicing your scales starting from do, or practicing your arpeggios maybe starting from, you know, the third note of the scale. Or why not, instead of practicing just three-note arpeggios, working on four-note arpeggios if that's something that you haven't already started practicing. Because, of course, when you're encountering sight reading, you know, you're reading a piece of music, and as we've been discussing, music is language. It's a form of language. And when I'm having a conversation with someone, when I'm reading through a book, I'm not, you know, there's always context, right? There's always context. You're not always starting every sentence from scratch. You're not always starting everything from the first note of the scale, the first note of the arpeggio. So being able to understand everything that you might encounter inside and out is one of those real fundamental things.
Yeah, and I would just add to that another fundamental technique, but thinking about your sound and concept and air and how you're using all that underneath this technical aspect of playing. But your fundamental sense of sound and air pressure and all the things that make a great sound, that's maybe one of the first things that goes away when we're sight reading. I hear it, you know, a lot with students. I've heard it a lot in auditions. Can hear someone's beautiful sound and their prepared music, and then a sight reading passage comes up and it just instantly, they become a different player sound-wise, and that fundamental thing goes away. And I think that's fairly natural for all of us. We're struggling with, you know, what we're seeing, and all this stuff's coming at us fast. And so you're doing what you can in the moment, But the more you have, again, that baseline of sound and preparation, with the goal of it not going away when you have something new coming at you, would be a great skill.
Right. So I love talking to my students about scales and how it pertains to sight reading. And it kind of keys in with this, that it's preparation you can do ahead of time. Band directors, this is also a reason you can give to your students when they ask, why do I have to practice scales? But Chris, you mentioned not just doing scales up and down, but doing them full range, doing them not starting on do, doing them in all these different ways. Because I think the idea is what you were talking about, Steve, and it's just having these skills internalized to the point where you're unconsciously competent about it. So we play our scales and we get familiar with that key signature, and our fingers do this thing, and correct me if you've never had this experience, but I do sometimes, where my brain goes, oh no, I'm messing up. Mm-hmm. I'm about to mess up. But then my fingers just play the right notes.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And when I'm practicing my scales, arpeggios, it's a daily thing, even still at this point, because the way that I'm approaching it on a regular basis is playing them as musically as possible. I don't want my scale to be, you know, following, of course the metronome is on, but not following it to the big beat. I'm looking at connecting notes, connecting lines, going to the peak of a phrase, coming back down the phrase, and approaching your scales, your arpeggios, all of those techniques in the most musical way possible, I would argue gets into the heart of what Steve is talking about, where you're thinking about your core sound. You're thinking about how you want to make, you know, what it is you're playing worth listening to.
I love that. I have my students think about the shape, you know, up and down a scale, fine. But even a scale has a shape and a certainty to it that you want them to give it. So thinking musically, even through fundamentals, is super important.
Okay, so now we're really getting into the meat of the conversation. So how would you practice sight reading? What can you do to improve just the natural ability? And for context, imagine you're talking to a advanced high school student, maybe early college student, someone who's taking music seriously, but wants to improve their sight reading and specifically set out to do that.
My approach has always been rhythm first. When I'm teaching sight reading actively, so I have this exercise I do with a lot of students where, well, first we'll just sing a line, the rhythms when I put something new in front of them. So sing through it, really make sure that you're keeping time, and distinguishing rhythm only. And then we'll introduce the horn, maybe just choose one note and play all the rhythms. Then I will... eventually, this is the best exercise, and I'll do it for them, and I'll play every note intentionally wrong, but I'll play the correct rhythms. So I sound like an idiot, and it's quite funny. And it's actually quite difficult to do, to let yourself really play everything wrong, note-wise. But the rhythms are all correct. And that sense of freedom that it gives students, I have found, has it just cracks something open. and then they try it, and it really releases them from going back and starting over. Because, you know, that's the urge, like, oh, I missed a note, I got to go back and correct it. And some people cannot break that habit. So I force them to break it by playing the notes completely wrong. And it's super fun for everybody. It sounds funny. But it brings a freedom then that you can just keep playing through a line. And eventually, you know, you integrate, and of course you want to get the notes right. But for some reason, that breaks this cycle of embarrassment or whatever over not getting the notes right initially. And so that's been a really fun technique that I've employed a lot.
It makes me think of, I wonder how many times in lessons, not necessarily intentionally as a teacher, but, you know, a kid's working through something that's challenging. And even if it's sight reading or it's not super familiar yet, and I'll just tell them to put the instrument down. And let's clap through this rhythm,
yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Let's find a way to ingrain this pattern. Whatever it is you're seeing, interpret it and internalize it, right? And make it a part of your experience working through this piece of music in this moment in time.
That exercise where you play intentionally wrong notes but the right rhythms, I don't know why, but it reminds me of Workers' Union. for those of you who don't know, it's a piece that... has a very specific rhythm that you play in unison with all of the other musicians, but the notes are just a vague suggestion of higher or lower. And I actually found that piece to be extremely difficult.
Challenging, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, you have rhythm like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then it tells you to move notes, and I found myself going to like the same notes. So that's funny that you mentioned that, just thinking of that piece. But I like how you talked about rhythm kind of being the bedrock of sight reading, like that's what comes first. So Chris, did you have any thoughts about rhythm in sight reading and is keeping that established grid of tempo going even when you don't know the notes?
Yeah, so one thing that, and Steve alluded to it, it's hard to practice sight reading by yourself because it's so easy for us to stop and go back and change something because we want to get it right. You know, and so when you're alone by yourself working on sight reading, being able to stay, you know, constantly looking ahead, because I've always felt that music is such an interesting language. It's such an interesting thing that we experience together, because not only do we have to live in the past, where have I come from musically, which leads to where I am right now. So I'm also living in the present, and all of that at the same time, I'm living in the future. I have to be constantly looking ahead and thinking, where is this going to take me? What is, you know, what's coming next? And that sense of kind of existing in all of those spaces at the same time is so challenging to juggle. And so when you're by yourself, you know, that sense of not stopping to go back and fixing something, if you don't have the luxury of playing along with a friend, maybe someone who's not musically inclined, or maybe someone who doesn't have an instrument that they're able to play with you, maybe you have a classmate or an older sibling or a younger sibling, someone you know, that you can take. This is a little hard to describe, but it's something that we'll use in lessons sometimes. They might be able to take a piece of paper that actually physically blocks your view of the music that has come before, right? So you have a piece of music, let's say it's 32 bars long, and you give yourself a minute to look at it all, and your friend starts with the note card or a piece of paper that's actually blocking the first measure when it's time for you to start. And as you go along, they drag it across and force you to not see what you're currently playing. So this sense of you can't go back and analyze what you've done. You can't go back and analyze where you've come from. You have to, you know, it forces you to look ahead. So it's something that we use sometimes. It's interesting in that it similarly, yeah. I'm guessing to the idea of playing the wrong notes on purpose, but keeping the rhythm there. It helps many students sort of shed that preconceived notion of what's right, what have I done well, and it forces them to just look ahead.
That's good. I'm going to use that.
I like that game. I'm actually a little curious to try that out myself and see how well I do.
It can be hard. It can be really challenging.
I think younger students too, we've probably had the experience where they are tempted to tap the rhythm.
Yes.
Instead of, you know, they're trying to keep a beat solid, but they end up maybe even with their foot or whatever, yeah, tapping the actual rhythms that they're seeing versus placing the rhythms in between the beats. So that's probably a pretty early on skill, but just developing that internalized sense of time.
So we're talking about this established grid and keeping that kind of going, like this continuous tempo, even if everything else fails, we're still keeping that time going. Is there a spot that you find students, especially younger students, tend to drop off that grid, like when they encounter a specific thing in the music?
Absolutely. Dotted rhythms.
Yeah.
As soon as the notes, as soon as there's more notes in front of you, mm-hmm. right? There's more information coming at you that you have to start processing. Tempo's slow as you're starting to process those things. But like dotted rhythms is a really big one. You know, if you're going to turn, you know, a dotted rhythm from, let's say, a dotted eighth, 16th into sort of a tripletized pattern, that's a big one. And you know, the more that you can work on, you know, finding those little spots, you know, okay, here's a spot that I read. It's five bars down and it's, you know, got a couple of dotted rhythms happening followed by a few 16th notes. I'm going to take an extra minute to look at that. and make sure that I really feel that 16th note pulse as best I can before I start playing it. That's a key spot.
Yeah, of course. Dotted rhythms, tied rhythms, irregular rhythmic, we'll say you have a 5-4 measure or something thrown in, or changing time signatures. So I guess another progression in the skill of sight reading could be to play only the first two beats of a measure and then let whatever happens in the third, fourth, or fifth, whatever the time is, let it trail off. But again, that they're keeping the skill of keeping the beat and knowing how many they've counted. That's another huge skill. So what if they're just getting the first notes of every measure they see, and we're not going to worry about the end of the measure? So that might be another skill where you're just keeping place, which I think is super important when things get complex.
You know, where I actually find a lot of students drop off the grid train is held notes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Totally. Just, it's so funny to think about, because it's, you know, those are quote unquote the easy notes. You know, I had a student the other day who was just absolutely crushing, you know, like da 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 da, like really hard rhythms. And then they got to a dotted half note and just dropped a whole beat and a half and moved on. And so if I'm constructing sight reading examples for anyone, I always make sure to throw in some random held notes just to make sure they've got that established grid and tempo underneath it, so they continue to sight read.
So true.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not actually necessarily part of sight reading, but that's something that happens pretty frequently in a lot of prepared things as well, for auditions and things, where folks might not necessarily be hearing the ensemble that they're playing with in their head, and you're hearing that time drop. Maybe they're looking ahead to the next challenging section, something like that. And granted, with sight reading, we don't have necessarily always have the luxury of knowing what ensemble playing is happening in the theoretical background of, you know, your piece of music in front of you. But at the same time, what you do have is the music that you've played and the music you're about to play, and really establishing that tempo internally, you know, internalizing that pace helps.
Actually, a specific example of this that I love is when someone plays the saxophone, or I guess clarinet and flute excerpt of the trio section from Rolling Thunder. The rests are usually what get people in trouble with time. And just that rest in between there, you got to leave room for the, was it trombones in the little interjections the second time through?
Well, how often in music is it that, you know, we encounter things that are pickups to the next measure, pickups to the, you know, this new idea that's coming? And one thing that can be visually jarring for us with a piece of music that's unfamiliar is you see the start of a phrase. Maybe it's following a rest. Maybe it's following a 16th note rest. You see that, and visually it's impactful as the beginning of something new. But the reality is maybe that's leading up to the start of a phrase, you know? And so how we approach, you know, where is the actual start of this idea, something that might be leading into it, that could help you.
Actually, anything you see that on a page when you're sight reading that might look black, like 16th notes.
Sure.
What's the tendency? Like panic, go faster. Even if the tempo is relatively manageable, you know, your tendency is to like go. Same with rest, you know. So our natural inclination, I think, is to panic, and we compress rests. We play things faster than they need to be if it looks like a 16th or a 32nd note. So allowing yourself the time to work through that, you know, what is a 16th note in, you know, it's 60. It's not going to be too fast. So yeah, actually, at the beginning of a sight reading excerpt, maybe if you have a tempo, you just go through the metric divisions. And, you know, just sing that, you know, what's a quarter, eighth, you know, really divide things in your head, just so you have that groundwork before you start playing. And you know, oh, a 16th note at this tempo is not going to be so fast.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about establishing that musical or rhythmic grid. We've talked about reading ahead and some exercises that help with those. But what are some resources for a student who wants something to sight read, something that they can use these concept on? These concepts on? Is there some sort of method book or repertoire you'd suggest?
So one of the things that I did before taking the audition that I ultimately won here with the Marine Band, I went to Ravelli Hall at Michigan, and I went down into the stacks and like buried in the deep back corner, and I found a whole bunch of orchestral transcriptions that were done by Von Suppe that nobody had been reading. And I mean, for clarinets at least, these are violin parts. Just straight violin parts all the way through, start to finish.
Meaning very difficult.
Yes. You know, not written for, you know, not written for this instrument, and they're orchestral transcriptions that just we would not encounter on a regular basis. And I would just sit and read, you know, maybe 30 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, and just go through charts and just sort of shed music that I'd never seen. I'd turn page, and just go, 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 go. That was one way that I did it. Another thing that we actually employ with lessons nowadays with students is we'll have them work through method books that are super unfamiliar to them. You know, so we've got in our studio, we've got a house full of clarinet players, and we've got a handful of trumpet books, and we've got a handful of other instruments. You know, maybe we've got some flute method books, and we'll ask a student to read down these B flat trumpet parts for a while that are just, you know, they might lay well on the clarinet, for example, but it's not something we've practiced. It's not something we're familiar with because we're not working through it on our regular weekly lessons. Or if you want to take it to another level with a student who is more advanced or the sight reading, you know, you're ready to kind of try something different, grab the flute part, but now you have to read it in clarinet. Right? You've got to read it in your key, so it's the correct key. Or, you know, just lots of different ways that you can approach method books that you might already have.
Yeah, we did that. I remember in school, too, Dr. Rousseau used to have us read flute duets, and those are going to be challenging because the range was a lot higher, and he was trying to push our range, but in a sight-reading kind of way. But I agree, like, your friends and colleagues who play different instruments, there's a lot of unfamiliar material for you right there. I have students now who use an online generator, like an app.
I've seen that.
I don't know exactly where they come from. and I think different school systems utilize this, so that might be a locality thing. But I know it exists where it can generate music at a certain grade or level.
I have my students do Sousa March parts that they've never played before. You know, how many of us have played John Philip Sousa's Harmonica Wizard? I mean, personally, I have, but I don't know if too many people outside of here have. So last question, I wanted to talk about sight reading a little bit in the context of our audition here at the Marine Band. We've all been behind the curtain when it's time to hire a new colleague, and I feel sometimes that people sort of misunderstand what we and potentially other judges behind a curtain look for. When judging sight reading, do you just sit behind the curtain and count the number of mistakes a player makes, or is it something deeper?
I think it's definitely something deeper. It's the overall sound this person is putting forward, their best attempt, of course, at seeing something brand new. But I'm not looking specifically at missed notes. It's the same thing I tell my students. I'm less interested in the notes, and I'm more interested in what they're conveying in a phrase or rhythmically. Again, I mentioned this earlier, is the sound changing or is their sound concept able to stay the same? And at least they're trying to make the most of something, even if they themselves are missing a lot or it's not going great. But how much can you retain that's fundamental and try and convey the sense of overall?
Yeah, I feel like with the audition process in general, so much of it is that level of preparation, you know, understanding a piece inside and out, hearing the ensemble that you would be playing along with, getting everything exactly right, dynamics, your articulation, the starts of notes, the ends of phrases, all of that preparation that you put into being ready for your audition. When you're sight reading in an audition, you're stripping away a lot of that. And what you're left with is, who is this person at their core musically, right? How are they going to approach this piece of music that they've never seen? And excuse me, the reality of that is we might be in a high profile situation and, okay, we need to do this piece. Wasn't on the rundown. Let's go. You've got a couple of seconds to take a look at it and you need to start. And you need to convey, like Steve is saying, everything that that piece of music has to offer for that moment in time.
Yeah, and I would add to that a technical point, which I don't think we've mentioned before, but how well is someone looking at the overall landscape of what's put in front of them? And I mean, taking a pretty macro view of what you're seeing, what are the shapes you're seeing? So is it scalar? Is it following, you know, a line, or are there big leaps? Is there something arpeggiated? So I think getting that macro view early on, you can tell if someone's done that. Is there a really big meter change or tempo change? That was one that stuck out recently in an audition and that was missed, but maybe seeing that at the beginning, like big meter shifts, big leaps. Of course, we're always scanning for accidentals and time signature and all the usual things, but what's the overall shape and landscape of an excerpt you're looking at?
Well, Steve, Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much.
This episode was written by Staff Sergeant Connor McKilla and produced and edited by Staff Sergeant Stephen Rudman. Recorded in John Philip Sousa Band Hall at Marine Barracks, Washington, D.C.